C+40. Drive-in, Birchwood, Colorado. The drive-in descended into absolute chaos as a discus-like alien craft gracefully landed just beyond the entrance gate. A small ramp then rapidly extended from the craft's main body to the ground, causing many of those in its vicinity to follow the countless others who had already fled in terror. It was a small craft, its diameter appearing no greater than the length of a commercial jet, and it rested flat on the ground. Both of these physical characteristics placed it in stark contrast to the enormous mothership-like craft Dan had encountered in Lolo National Forest, which had dominated the valley and rested upon a retractable metallic pillar at an odd angle. In the seconds before the visitors from another world emerged from their vessel, a question crossed Dan's mind. What if these aren't the same ones? Around a third of those present in the drive-in were already gone, running as fast and as far as they could. Dan looked beyond those who remained and watched disbelievingly as two bipedal aliens, side by side, smoothly walked down their gently angled ramp and touched down on Earth. Even across the full distance of the drive-in lot, he could tell it was them. The messengers stopped at the base of their ramp, both of their gazes trained firmly on Dan. Some reporters flashed their cameras, while the largest number yet turned and ran to join those who had already fled. The aliens, just as Dan remembered, wore a seamless white fabric, which covered all of their bluish-silver skin, other than their bulbous heads and slender hands. Those reporters brave enough to have remained near the ramp could now make out the large primate-like eyes which dominated the messengers' neotenous faces. One of the messengers raised a hand. It was composed of two wide finger-like divisions and one highly dexterous thumb. And at this, the remaining mass of humanity within the drive-in lot immediately began dividing into two sections. Dan watched as everyone else directly in front of the messengers, including Clark, covered their ears and ran one way or the other. Force fields, Dan realized. They're clearing a path. Even the assailant who Clark had flattened with a stiff blow now rose to his feet and stumbled out of the otherwise deserted zone as quickly as he could, leaving a totally empty area between Dan's elevated position and the two messengers. Some cameras and other recording equipment littered the area, but the intensity of the sound waves within the zone prevented anyone from trying to get back in. Anyone that was, except for Clark, who gritted his teeth and made a laudable effort to reach the stairs and protect Dan. But for the first time in Clark's life, pain truly got the better of him. The intensity of the sensation he experienced on the wrong side of the threshold forced him to retreat and left him standing helplessly at the edge of the vacant walkway along with everyone else, stuck on the outside looking in. Even more clearly than had been the case at Lolo, this force field was explicitly marked by the effect it had on those who tried to cross it. And while the walkway was relatively narrow, perhaps only 15 feet in width, Dan's perspective made it impossible not to think of Moses and the crossing of the Red Sea. As the messengers began walking towards Dan, he made his way down the stairs and took a few tentative steps towards them. When he was past the first of the abandoned cameras, he knew that he alone was permitted on this side of the mysterious threshold. He stopped again and watched the expressionless messengers walking slowly but steadily towards him. They were here. They were really here. Dan's expression, however, was not the most welcoming. They were here a day after Timo and Emma had almost been blown to pieces. They were here weeks after indirectly warning Dan of an approaching comet without doing anything to help humanity deal with it. They were here far too goddamn late. Where were you yesterday? Dan yelled, the anger boiling over in his voice and expression. You can come to stop Walker from talking, but not to stop Emma and Timo from being blown up? And the comet? Why won't you just stop it? Divert it? Why the hell would you only tell us about it when you know there's nothing we can do about it? And with that thought, Dan's walk turned into a run. The messengers continued, still expressionless, until Dan came within reach and lunged forward to lash out. At that point, one of the messengers raised a hand, bringing forth a sudden force which pushed Dan backwards through the air and sent him to the ground with a rough thud.
Vipat la.
Mis lop tak so. The same messenger vocalized. Its tone fell abruptly at the end of each short and melodic phrase, in precise keeping with the vocal pattern Dan recalled so vividly from his prior meeting with the messengers at Lolo. Dan tried again to lunge forward, displaying a near vitriolic rage at the messengers, which he hadn't expected for one second. But unlike the path-clearing threshold which Clark had been able to cross for a few seconds, this was a hard barrier more in keeping with the force field Clark had run into, face first, in Richard Walker's house. Dan's hands pushed against the invisible barrier in a manner akin to a performing mime. "Stop hiding behind your stupid force fields!" he yelled before unthinkingly running towards them again. Unlike Clark, he had a reason to see the impact coming and should have known better than to collide with the equivalent of an invisible brick wall. But, just like Clark, the collision earned him a bloody and likely broken nose. Dan fell backwards, clasping his face, before pushing himself to his feet once more and staring at the approaching aliens with fury in his eyes. Dan's injury prompted Clark to dash forward again, momentarily forgetting the ear-splitting pain he would bring upon himself by doing so. As before, he only made it a few steps. The same messenger that had created the initial force field then held an open palm towards Clark, freezing him to the spot on the safe side of the threshold. Clark couldn't talk, but the awkwardness of his stance and the utterly static expression on his face left no one in any doubt that he had been involuntarily immobilized. Reacting to this, an attendant police officer attempted to raise his firearm in the messenger's direction, but found his hand unable to grasp it. He, too, was frozen and silenced, but no one was paying enough attention to notice. As he looked across the drive-in lot in the direction of his helpless brother, Dan couldn't believe his eyes. "What the hell are you doing?" he yelled at the messengers. "What are you—" Mid-word, Dan's body was similarly paralyzed by the same messenger's outward-facing palm. He tried to move and tried to talk, but nothing happened. He could look around and he could blink. His eye muscles were unaffected, but that was the full extent of the physical control he could now exert over his own body.
"Lesh namti, ku,"
the messenger said, its sing-song-like tone somehow soothing Dan's intense discomfort.
"Benoslad, hik."
The second messenger then placed its hand on the leader's back. Footage would later reveal that it was reaching into a small, pouch-like opening in the apparently seamless fabric of the full-body garment and produced a thin metallic cable. Dan knew what was coming next, but the moment when the cable was connected to the back of his neck was far more painful than last time. He couldn't move or talk, but he could certainly feel, and never in his life had he felt anything like this. Many of the remaining crowd, terrified of what they were seeing, could no longer look. But when the leading messenger connected the other end of the cable to its own hand, all of Dan's pain disappeared. The world disappeared. Now it seemed like there was nothing in the world but him and the extraterrestrial being which stood not 3 feet from his face.